All right. So, morning, everybody. Welcome. Thank you, everybody, for coming back. I'm honored that we've been able to sustain a crowd for the first two shiurim. Yasher koach to the Bermans for the sponsoring the delicious breakfast. Was it any particular honor other than love and passion? Love and passion for Zionism. I would say. Yeah. All right. So in honor of the Artzino Akdosha, the Bermans have sponsored it, so we thank them. Okay, so I want to pick up where we left off. The title of today's shiur and the focus that I'd like to give it is in the medieval period. But we left off last time in long before, about 800 years before we can get to the medieval period, which is really at the midpoint of the Chazal's history. So page one over here is kind of finishing that history. I'd like to get through it pretty quickly, and then we're going to shift into attitudes in the Rishonim. Where did we leave off? We left off, anybody remembers, it was a few weeks ago, but if you remember, we left off in the year 220. In the year 220, Abba Aricha, known as Rav, right? The 220 is basically marking the death of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, which we usually, in history, we like to point to that date as the day where the Mishnah was finally completed. So the Mishnah, which was the first text, the first canonized text of the Torah Sheba'al Peh that was written down for the first time, so now is, for all intents and purposes, completed around the beginning of the 3rd century. And Abba Aricha, who is the chief Talmud, the chief student of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who had completed the Mishnah, basically picks up and goes to Bava. Okay, so that's a little bit of a strange thing to do if you don't know the background. Right? We looked at it last time. The Jewish community of Babel basically has been around for 500-600 years now. When Jehoiachin was first exiled with several, Jehoiachin, who was the king of Yehuda, when he was exiled in 589 BCE, that was basically the kickstart. He was exiled with thousands of Jews, and that was the start of the Jewish community in Babel. Since that point, since 8 centuries, this Jewish community in Babel has been growing. The thing is, while there was education in Babel during all of those years, during those centuries, Eretz Yisrael, during all of those years, was still the center, obviously the entire Bayit Sheni period, and even after the Churban, Eretz Yisrael was still considered the very center of Jewish education in the world. So, during those years, that's why, right, when we spoke about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and the starting of the Yeshiva in Yavne last time, during this period, the majority of the learning, and anybody who wants to go and study Torah from the main Jewish communities in Bavel, they're still going to Eretz Yisrael. Abba Aricha, right, who was basically the person that moves and starts the period of the Amoraim, the period of the Gemara, Rav and Shmuel, who was his counterpart, grew up and were part of this community in Bavel. They both are foreign exchange students in Eretz Yisrael, studying under Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. In Yavne and in the Galil, there was a lot of tumultuous stuff going on in those years post-Churban, but it was still the center of Jewish learning. With the death of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and the return of Rav and Shmuel to Bavel, that is what creates the great shift. Until that point, Eretz Yisrael is considered the center of Jewish learning. From that point on, for the next 800 years, Bavel is considered the center of Jewish learning. Now, it's very important to realize we are so influenced by the Talmud Bavli, by the Babylonian Talmud, to the extent that most of us don't know anything at all about the Talmud Yerushalmi. We've seldom learned anything from the Jerusalem Talmud, but the Jerusalem Talmud is a testament to the fact that for several centuries after Rav and Shmuel pick up and go to Bavel and start the yeshivot there, there is a vibrant study still going on, mostly in the north, in the Galil, in the yeshiva of Tveria, and we'll take a look at that also as well. So, everybody just keep that in mind. Even though we're going to be speaking mostly about Babel for the next few minutes, there is still a vibrant yeshiva, study going on in Israel. It just becomes all of a sudden second fiddle to Babel because of the stature of Rav and Shmuel. All right, so that brings us to the top of over here. All right, so again, by popular demand, I got a lot of good feedback about this timeline. So just for page one, I brought it back just to summarize these events. The year 220 is the year that Rav goes back to Bavel. Now, there was already a yeshiva set up in Nahar Dah. Right? Now, if everybody wants to take a look at the back page over here, I mapped a lot of the places that we're going to be talking about, so you have a general idea. So everybody, this is the divisions, the country divisions are modern day divisions, so you have an idea of where we're looking at. The Babel, of course, is where modern day Iraq is. So if you take a look over here in modern day Iraq, I'm sorry, you can put these back there. If you look at that, modern-day Iraq, so you see Sura, Pumbedita, and Nahar Dah, those are the three centers, the three yeshiva centers in Bubba. So Nahar Dah, Rav first goes in 220, and he sets up shop in Nahar Dah, where there already was a pre-existing yeshiva. Shmuel is there as well. He was there a few years earlier than him. Rav's family, Rav grew up in southern Babel, or about, I think about 100 miles south, in where Sura is. Sura had a Jewish community and no education there. So Rav, after a few years in Nahar Dah, picks up and goes down to Sura. And he sets up shop there and he starts yeshiva there. Now that is probably the most pivotal point for this whole period. Basically what happened was he leaves the yeshiva, the running of the yeshiva in Nahar Dah, to Shmuel, and he goes down south about 100 miles and starts a yeshiva in Sura. And he leaves it in Nahar Dah. He sets up one in Sura. So now you have these two academies, alright, which are, in those days, the 100 miles is a huge distance. So they were very far from one another, but they were the two masters of the entire Jewish people who are teaching them. So that lent stature to these two academies, these two yeshivot. And basically what happened was they have like a little bit of a give and take over the next several centuries about which is more prominent and which is less prominent. But essentially, these two yeshivot in Sura and Nahar Dah, and eventually Nahar Dah changes to Pumbedita, which is nearby, you can see on the map, these are the centers of learning. Two different centers, and two different centers, but two centers that very much complemented one another, and even though there were several arguments between these two, everybody knows the famous Barei Plukta in the Gemara, the people, the interlocutors in the Gemara that are very often arguing are Rav and Shmuel. That, when you take a look at this history, it makes a lot more sense. They were not just two guys sitting in a room arguing with each other. They were two heads of two different academies, having two different curriculums and two different ways of analyzing things, two different ways of looking at things. When you keep that in mind, all right, think about it in terms of, you know, it's a guy from NYU and a guy from UC Irvine. Let's say those are the two leading schools in nuclear physics, whatever it is. So you have the two leaders who are heading the two nuclear physics departments, and those two universities, I made that up. I don't know anything about nuclear physics. But you have these two universities that are opposing. So they're constantly publishing articles at one another. Yeah, that guy didn't know what he was talking about. And then the next issue of that, of the nuclear physics journal, that guy says, no, he was totally wrong. That's basically what's going on when you have the machlokot of Rav and Shmuel. Right? There are these two yeshivot that are operating very much involved with one another, but they are representing two different schools. There is communication in the same way that there is communication for the next, 2,000 years in Jewish history. There was merchants, there was families, there was people in... People would write, people would correspond, and people would be traveling between these... 100 miles is a long time, is a long place, but it's New York to Philadelphia. So, if you think about it in 18th century America, even though that was a very far distance, and it took you 2 weeks to get there, all right, it's still... there was still a ton of travel going on. So there was a lot of connection between these two places, but they still represented two different academies. The people that were sitting and learning in yeshiva were sitting and learning exclusively. And the communities that were supporting these yeshivot were happening at the, corresponding with one another. Okay, so that's an important piece of history in terms of just appreciating the development of Chazal and how these multiple locations actually take place. Now, As I was emphasizing last time, appreciating the wider context of what's going on in the history of the world here is very significant. Somebody have a question? Taking a rudimentary history of the generations of that Amoraim it opens up a page of Gemara exponentially. Now, there are lots of people, we can debate this another time, but there's lots of people who say that is a fruitless waste of time, that it doesn't matter what generation of the Amora is that you're talking about. We need to picture everybody in the same room. That's a very common trope, and please don't think that I'm disparaging that in any way. I think it's a perfectly valid opinion. Personally, my Anitiya is to look into that stuff And because usually I can make inferences, I can understand the sugya, I can understand what the Gemara is saying a little bit better when I realize that Hillel and Shammai were two opposing academies that were in Eretz Yisrael, one in the north and one in the south, and one in the center, and Rav and Shmuel were two opposing academies 200 years later in Bava. But again, we can debate that another time. The point is that Harper is 100% correct. These things were being reported by Talmidim. Somebody would transfer from Surah to Pumbedita, from Pumbedita to Surah. They would bring, the Gemara has full all of these the examples of Rabbanim going here and bringing these discussions that were brought up. The same Mishnah was being discussed by Shmuel in Shmuel and Naharda. And he goes to Surah and he says, let me tell you what Shmuel said on this. The Gemara does this all the time. So, again, just to appreciate in terms of that, and you have the visual, you can see on the map just how separated they are. Okay, so again, in terms of the wider world, what's going on in the world right now, so we all know that in the year 70, the Roman Empire came and sacked Jerusalem and destroyed the independent Jewish sovereignty over the land of Israel and exiled a lot of Jews. Now, the exile was partially an exile, partially an enslavement, but it was also partially a refugee crisis. Right, everybody was a tsaros when the Romans attacked Israel. So a lot of people picked up and they went to the next largest Jewish community, which was where? It was Bava. So over these years, even though the center of learning remained in Eretz Yisrael, the Jewish communities in Bava grew exponentially. Why? Because shortly thereafter, right? And the history here, it's can't be a coincidence. I'm not an expert in any history, but particularly in this area. I knew the stuff we were talking about last week a lot better than I do this period. But what's going on in the world right now? In the year 224, the Sasanian Empire it takes over the eastern part of the Roman Empire. So in the year 224, which if you're seeing here, it's coinciding with the years of this starting this academies of these yeshivot, which is why it can't be a coincidence. In the year 224, the Sasanian Empire, which was based in Iran, so it's the Neo-Persian Empire, that's how it's referred to usually in the academic literature. The Neo-Persian Empire, which is basically a rejuvenation of the Persian Empire from 500 years earlier with Koresh and Artaxerxes, and the Purim story. So the Persian Empire kind of retakes it. Now, I didn't mark it here, but if you look at the map, the Persian Empire basically go about two-thirds along Turkey, two-thirds from the left of Turkey, and draw a line down, like a vertical line down. That's pretty much where the Sasanian Empire, the Neo-Persian Empire, ended. Now, if you look at that, where is that line? What is that line between? Draw a line about two-thirds of the way across Turkey. Turkey is the big horizontal country to the north of Israel and Lebanon. So if we draw that line, what have we now drawn a line between? The two great centers of Jewish learning, one in Eretz Yisrael and one in Babel. Okay? So again, at the same time that the Talmud academies in Babel are being formed, there is a huge shift geopolitically in the world. We now have the two main centers of the Jewish community are now being separated by two empires who do not like each other. So while contact between the Yeshivot and Babel is immense, and there's still lots of travel and contact between Eretz Yisrael and Babel, there's less, and it becomes more complicated. Okay, that's just in terms of the context. Okay, so in terms of the general context of what's going on in the 3rd century. So if you'll notice here, the blue boxes are specific events, the green are periods. So let's just go through this very quickly. So in 225, there's the, we're again, Shmuel and Rav. Now we have these two yeshivot in operation. And this is basically what starts the period of the Gemara. 220 to 500 roughly, and I made the same disclaimer last week, most of these dates are debatable. All right, I put them in here for simplicity's sake, but you're going to have people who are debating. Sometimes it's a big debate, it could be all 50 or 100 years off. Sometimes it could be 10 to 15 years off, but I just left them here. And just know that several of these are debatable. But roughly speaking, 220 to 500 is the period of the Gemara. Around the year 500 is when Ravina and Ravashi, first Ravashi and then Ravina afterwards, Ravina who's the second person of that name actually, they finally compile and seal, to a certain extent, seal the Talmud. And there's about six or seven generations that happen of Amoraim from the year 220, from when Rav and Shmuel first set up shop until the closing of the Talmud. That's in a nutshell. That's really the period of the Gemara. Now, at the same time, right, parallel, there's the Talmud Yerushalmi is being written, but it gets closed 75 years earlier. Right, that happened in 425. You see, the office of the Nasi of the Jewish population of Roman Palestine is dissolved. Right, that's the 425 mark, marking the closing completion of the Jerusalem Talmud. So, as you see here, right, and I didn't do enough to illustrate this, but there is a decline over these centuries in the prominence and stature, and even the scholarship of the Jewish community and the learning centers in Eretz Israel, while the centers in Babel are on the rise. They are become the de facto centers of halakhic Judaism. Now, yes, Ali.
I'm not sure if it's when is the redacting of the piece of the Mishnah thing?
So, I mean, that was what we kind of finished up with last week. That's when I started with it. 220. The Mishnah is basically being written from, the material for the Mishnah is basically being started from about 150 years before the Churban Bayis Sheni. You know, the Mishnah is all in Eretz Israel. Okay, so the first, this is with last year, last time's year. The first characters in the Mishnah that we see, the first names that we see, are the Zugot. First we have Shimon HaTzadik. He's the earliest one. He's from the Mishiaris Knesset HaGadola, the Anshe Knesset HaGadola. And then we have Shmai V'Atalion, and you know, Shimon Ben Shetach, and Hillel and Shammai. So there's five generations of Zugot, and then we get into the Tanayim. Right, at the end of the Zugot is when the Churban Bayis Sheni happens. And then, for another 150 years, they're writing the Mishnah. 220, it gets closed. And then 220 is basically coinciding with the Sasanian Empire starting to take things over. Rav and Shmuel set up shop in Babel, and that's where starting where the Gemara is. So there's a titanic shift going on, geopolitically going on in the world as all this is starting. So then we have the next 250 years where we're writing the Gemara. And at the same time, things are declining, and in 425, the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, gets finished. Okay. So what happens? So it is untrue, all right, and this is what I was taught when I was growing up, and it is not true, that in the year 500, when Ravina and Ravashi finished writing the Gemara, that we now have the Vilna Shas, you know, where we open up the Tamakos and Yud-Beis Amad Beis to look at a sugya. That was not the case. They, basically what Ravina and Ravashi did, all right, in a nutshell, is they basically said, this is in and this is out. These texts are in and these texts are out. And they had a big pile of Maseches Erevin, and in all the texts that they wanted in Maseches Erevin, they basically put in one pile, and the stuff that they didn't want, they put in the second pile. In a nutshell, that's basically what Ravina and Ravashi were doing. The next 150 to 250 years, I mentioned this last time, are probably possibly the most important 250 years in the history of rabbinic halakhic Judaism. Those are the years in which the big pile that Ravina and Ravashi left for Masechet Erevin were put together, and the way Chaim Soloveitchik puts it, Dr. Soloveitchik puts it, he calls it copy editing. So all of the stuff was written, all the opinions were written, all of the material was there, but what needed to be done was it needed to be put together in some sort of cohesive unit. Now, any of us who have learned Gemara, which I'm sure is many of us, we know that sometimes it can't be so cohesive, so we sometimes question what job they did. But you always have to keep in mind that we don't speak Persian, we don't speak Aramaic, and we don't live in 5th century Babylonia. So that's why sometimes a lot of this stuff is a little bit difficult. That being said, it is a little bit difficult. That period is known. It was known for a long time as the Savaroyim. David Weiss Halivni, who's a professor of Talmud and specializes in the development of this particular area of Jewish history, he kind of changed their name. He calls them the Stamaim, because he suggests that they were not only just putting together and copy editing. Professor Halivni thinks that they were actually adding in some of the anonymous material that we find in the Gemara. So they weren't just copy editing, but they were actually adding as well. So, regardless of how you say it, the form that we have of the Torah Shebal Peh in the Talmud took shape during this period. Now, I put roughly over here, roughly 500 to 700. We know almost nothing about this period. I mentioned last time that the period of the Anshe Knesset HaGadola was probably the most important period in Jewish history, and we know pretty much nothing about them. All right? This is the only thing that I think, the only period in history that I think can rival that. And we know almost as much as nothing about it. If anybody wants a really good parallel, speak to Michael Pell afterwards about the history of rock and roll. No? He made a really good argument to me last night about why they're parallel. Okay, so This is a very, very pivotal moment in Jewish history, this period of the roughly 500 to 700. At the end of this period of the Savaroyim, or coinciding with the end, or maybe starting towards the beginning, the beginning of, which was, again, it's so hazy, these dates and these figures, because we don't know anything about it, so it's hard to say what one ended and one started. But the first period where we have the study and the decision-making and the halachic discourse based on the Talmud Bavli is the period that immediately follows the period of the Savaroyim. That's the period of the Gaonim. And that's when we start to get the type of things that the type of halachic works that we're familiar with. That's when Rav Saji Gaon operated, right? That's when Rav Achai Gaon operated. That's when we start getting real halachic works that, or we don't know, most of those we don't use so much. Rav Saji Gaon is really the exception, but these are the works that were relied upon by Rashi, the Ramban. These were the ancient Jewish halachic texts, the ones that were produced during the Gaonic period, that really gave birth to the halachic texts that we use that are household items. So you see from the development here, from 220 through the end of the Gaonic period, there's a very clear system, a very clear sequential history of what's going on and where. Now, I'll just make one more point. It's important to appreciate, like I said, the contextual history of all of this. By and large, during the period of Chazal, during the period of the Gemara, Jewish community in Bavel thrived immensely. They were well connected. Again, another thing that you notice if you learn a lot of Gemara, anybody who learns Daf Yomi definitely can appreciate this. There's so many references in the Gemara to discussions, relationships with the ruling class, with the local government, with the local rule. That's all because of the prominence of the Jewish community at the time. The Sasanian Empire basically gave the Jewish community in Bavel carte blanche to do whatever they want. They had complete religious autonomy. They had, and for all intents and purposes, they had self-rule. There was a political hierarchy. There was a political structure. There was a halachic center. So the Jewish community was going on all cylinders. It was busting on all cylinders during these centuries. That changes. There's a major shift that happens. What's the next major shift that happens? Who takes over the Middle East after the Sasanian Empire?
Islam.
Right, exactly. Islam takes over, and I put the date in here. 610, Muhammad is when Muhammad, who is an orphan turned merchant from an Arabian city called Mecca, at age 40 begins to report revelations that he believes are from God. His followers spread his visions and found the Islamic faith, which united all of Arabia into a single polity through the spread of religious doctrine and military conquest. All right, so that was 610 is when Muhammad starts claiming he has Nubuwwah. It takes many years, but Not that many years, but it takes a couple of decades. But this spreads like wildfire in the Arabian Peninsula, and then they start conquering. So Abu Bakr, who's in Arabic lore, is a legendary figure, right? So he was really the father-in-law of Muhammad, one of the fathers-in-law. He had a lot of wives, but the Abu Bakr was one of his successors. He was the first caliph. And he basically is the one that first sets up an army and begins the Muslim conquest of the Middle East. So that's in 632. He sends an army, and he basically conquers Babel from the Sasanian Empire. So the end of Persian rule is at this point, in the 632 and then the next few years. So in the initial years, basically the only thing that changes is that everything's okay in Babel, but we have to pay taxes. So there's new taxes that we need to pay to the Islamic Caliphate. But other than that, things are going okay. But this does signal the beginning of a decline in the stature and the prominence of the Jewish community. Now, while that's going on, the other communities, the communities outside of Babel, start to be on the rise, right? So this is usually in our long history of Galut, right? There's a lot of this. There's this, as one center starts to fall, another one starts to rise. So as Babel begins, and again, it was prominent for several more centuries, but as it begins to decline, that's when we have the first evidence of learning centers that are going on in Spain. And about 100 years later, we have the first evidence of the learning centers that are going on in Ashkenaz. That's pretty much it in terms of what I wanted to say about the development of this history. The Gaonic period lasts until the year 1040. Suram Pumbedita, for 800 years, are the centers of Jewish learning in Bava. And in the year 1034, in the year 1040, that was when the last of the Gaonim died, right? And the 1040 was really the murder of Chizkiah ben David. And by that point, there were major learning centers outside of Bavel, and that basically spelled the decline of the prominence of the Babylonian Jewish community, right? So that, again, that was just a very quick run through that I wanted to do of the Jewish history during the period of Chazal and immediately thereafter, which basically gave birth to the period of the Rishonim. Yeah.
Well, you noted that Tzadikov was a non-native of
Bavel. Correct. He was the only Gaon in the entire Gaonic period that was not a native of Bavel. Politics very much colored the Jewish life during the years in Bavel. People were well connected. It was a family business, the Gaoni. Now these were very capable people, but there was a lot of father to son, you know, inheriting of the position. So where he was from Egypt. So the Egypt community is growing immensely also. Now the Rambam gets, we'll get to the Rambam in a couple minutes. Rambam gets to Egypt in the middle of the 12th century, and he laments what a bunch of Amoratim everybody there are. The entire Egypt is a bunch of ignoramuses. The Rambam pretty much thought the entire world was a bunch of ignoramuses. So, you know, what that actually says about the Egyptian community, yeah.
The fact that Sanhedrin broke the mold, is that Stephen's brilliance? Or
yes. I mean, we could spend multiple shiurim just on Tzadikov, but Tzadikov was a very, very important figure. I tried to give a little bit of an ode to him in the little blurb that I wrote here, but he was a very, very, he was a trailblazing figure in a lot of different ways. If anybody's interested, Robert Brody has a book that was translated into English a couple years ago on Tzadikov. It's not too long, it's about 200 pages long. Excellent. Required reading. Okay, so that pretty much brings us to the period of the Rishonim. Any questions? Any other questions? Everybody with me? Again, all I'm trying to do here is just trying to... The period of the Rishonim, I didn't understand this when I was first started learning. In my ninth grade, they gave me a Gemara and they gave me a Rashba, and they told me to open up the Rashba. And I said, okay, that's really interesting. Where was the Rashba from? This is a question my father told me to ask. Where's the Rashba from? So my Rebbe actually knew something. He said he was from Spain. So I said, oh, that's really cool. How did he get to Spain? So, you know, this is a question that I've always had. So until I started looking into this stuff, I think it's really important that we appreciate the Rishonim didn't just, you know, pop up out of nowhere. There was a huge history and legacy of Talmudic erudition that they were the inheritors of. They were the that they were carrying on. Okay, so let's move to the rest. Now, for the rest of our time together, this is going to take less of a sequential historical approach, and I really want to kind of get into the world of ideas. The question now that we have, right, and I it was not by chance that I emphasized the importance of the role of the Jewish community in, you know, the old Yishuv, the role of the Jewish community in the land of Israel during this period. While for several centuries there was a very active, very vibrant community in the land of Israel, and not only that, but in certain areas they actually were more prominent. Is anybody here familiar with the history of the Aleppo Codex? Mm-hmm. Anybody ever hear anybody talk about it, read a book or something about it? So the Aleppo Codex, when was the Aleppo Codex written? When was it put together? Right. 9th, 10th century, I think the scholarly consensus right now is it's early 10th century. That was done in Tiberia. The reason why it was done in Tiberia is because, if you look at your map, right, the centers of learning in Israel were mostly in the north. They were in Tzipori, they were in Akko, they were in Tiberia, and they were in Caesarea. And then, several centuries later, they get to Tzfat, when we'll get there. There was a vibrant Jewish community there, right? And this is something that we all need to appreciate. And as we get into, you know, the more modern Tzionut, as we get into the Hakamat HaMedina, and you have the founding fathers of the State of Israel who were screaming, we've been here for 2,000 years, and people were saying, no, you haven't been. It's really, the history is abundantly clear that it wasn't like there, we left Emperor Titus destroyed Israel and left a minion in the year 70, and that we just made sure that we were funding a minion the entire time. There was a lot more than a minion in Israel, in the land of Israel. There was a vibrant Jewish community that they were really the leaders of scholarship in the world of Torah Shivatzav, which makes sense, which is why the authoritative text on Tanakh was produced. This was not in the year 400. It was It was 800-900 years after the Churban. The reason why the authoritative text of Tanakh was able to be produced in the land of Israel 900 years after the Churban, 800 years after the Churban, is because of the vibrance and importance of the study in the cultural center that was going on, the world of learning that was going on in Eretz Israel. That being said, it was always second fiddle to Bavel. All of these Sheilot during the Gaonic period, throughout the entire diaspora, were going to Bavel. The Gaonim of Bavel were answering all the halakhic questions, and we uncovered so much of this in the Cairo Geniza, the correspondence that was going back and forth for centuries to the Gaonim in Bavel. We don't have anything from Bavel. So if there was the equivalent of the Cairo Geniza, that was in Iraq. I mean, it might be there, just, you know, there. As I'm sure everybody realizes, they're not really all that keen in helping us out in uncovering Jewish history. But the what we have is Egypt, and the Jewish community in Egypt and Cairo preserved so much of this correspondence, so that you always have to take it with a grain of salt because of how far it was from the cultural center. But we actually have material, pieces of paper that were written, signed by Gaonim in the 700s. We actually have that. And that was all uncovered in the Cairo Geniza. We have much more of a fuller sense of the type of questions than the type of halakhic discourse that was going on during that period. Now we get to the period of the Rishonim. Now, like I said, I want to kind of shift into the world of ideas right now. We have a land of Israel. The land of Israel, while has had a very prominent Jewish community for many years, shortly with the decline of the Babylonian Jewish community, there's a similar decline in the Palestinian Jewish community is what it's usually referred to. While there always remains a Jewish community there, there is never a vibrant Jewish community. And there's always on the mind of many, many people, of many, many leading Jewish figures and regular, everyday, average Joes, to go back. But the infrastructure doesn't really exist. So what I want to talk about right now is how they dealt with that. Right? It is by no means the case that people didn't care about Israel. I always say every year during Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur that if we only could, the people that are claiming that we don't have any history in the land of Israel, it's very hard for me to hear. And I always say that I wish, if nothing else, let's just give them the Yom Kippur mafzer that everybody's been davening out of for the last 2,000 years. There is a yearning for Tzion that has been going on since the Churban. It's part of our. It's part of our very soul. It's part of our liturgy. It's part of our existence. It's part of our davening. It's part of what we talk about. People have been ending Divrei Torah for 2,000 years that we should be having the Bias Gol Tzedek soon and finally go back to Yerushalayim. It's not that has been going on for a very long time. So we get into the world of the medieval period where we have these vibrant Jewish communities outside of Bavel and outside of the land of Israel, much further away. And we have Jewish leaders who are talking and thinking and wondering about what to do about the land of Israel. And that gave birth, the religious fervor of that period gave birth to a lot of really interesting ideas. Now, just again, take a quick look at the map. Appreciate how far away we are now. Because we're now entering the world of Ashkenaz, right? The world of Germany, the world of France, and the world of Spain. You can appreciate how far away we are, just geographically, from the land of Israel. Now, in the medieval time, this is an entire world away. But this is where the Jewish community is now centered. So, let's go through a few of these. Anyone here ever hear of the Hasidei Ashkenaz? Who can tell me something about the Hasidei Ashkenaz? What do we know about them? They were not Satmar Hasidim with Payas and Ashtrayna. That's usually the first thing we need to say about the Hasidei Ashkenaz. They lived in Ashkenaz in Germany in the early Middle Ages. What else do we know about them ideologically?
Rabbi Yehuda
Chassid did not, but we'll get to it. Ashkenaz did not have much representation. It was mostly French that were making Aliyah, but they were thinking about it, as we'll see in a second. Anybody know anything ideologically about Hasidei Ashkenaz? Were they type A or type B? I'm a psychologist, so I got to throw that in there.
Type A.
They were very much type A. They were very, very, very type. They were the paradigm of type A. They were very meticulous and Hasidim in the original sense of the word. That they lived and breathed for a religious observance in every respect. They believed in certain doctrines that many people in the Jewish, leading Jewish figures, halakhic figures, have spoken out against. Asceticism, they were into a lot of things. Basically, constant striving for perfection. That was the cultural heritage of Ashkenaz that was going on, at least in a certain pocket of it. Yeah?
How big was the group?
Good question. I don't know. It depends on what point in history. I remember hearing Dr. Soloveitchik once say that, I mean, this isn't Ashkenaz, this is France, but the number of people that Rashi grew up in Troyes, he was born in Troyes. The number of people that lived in the number of Jews that lived in Rashi's town in Troyes was fewer than the average floor of an apartment building in Brooklyn. That was there was barely a minion in Troyes. So by and large, these were not huge Jewish communities. There were definitely centers, but once the yeshivot start popping up, that's when people start migrating and centering around particular places. Anyway, so Rabbi Yehuda Chassid is basically the godfather he is the progenitor of the Hasidic Ashkenaz. He lived from 1150 to 1217. He's from Regensburg, all right? If you're looking at the map, Regensburg is, you'll see, it's the southeast of Germany, all right? You'll see, I marked it off over there. And Rabbi Yehuda Chassid was very much a halachic leader. All right, the Sefer Hasidim, which is a very important work of Jewish philosophy, was authored by him. That kind of mapped out the philosophy of the Hasidic Ashkenaz. Sheila, we're in source number 1 on page 2. Im yelech adam la'eretz, this is a halakha question being asked him. All right, and this is a tshuva that was actually uncovered by Professor Yisrael Tashma, zichrono lebracha, 30 years ago. Sheila, im yelech adam la'eretz Yisrael avur avonotav, what should he do? A person can either take the easy way out, and this is the question. I can go to and just go live in Israel, and that way I can have and think about the cultural drive to ask this type of question. The shiloh that's being asked now is, I have all of these averot, I have all of these sins that are on my ledger, and I got to get rid of them. What's the best way to do it? Should I go to Israel and have them wiped away, which we'll see in a second. The Gemara in Ketubot actually says that if you go to Israel, your sins are wiped clean. Or should I stay home and learn Torah? And if I stay home and I can learn Torah, and that way and do other mitzvot, and that way I'll have my sins wiped clean. So it's an interesting shaila. We're used to asking the rabbi, I dropped my fleshed spoon in the milk pot while the soup going on. This is the shaila being asked to, right? You ever get this shaila, Rabbi?
I guess shaila's going to go to Israel, yes.
Uh-huh. Not phrase this way. All right, this is definitely one of my faves. Tshuva, and he gives an answer. All right, this is a published responsa. Nira be'enai, misha holech le'eretz Yisrael adraba. Somebody who goes to the land of Israel, he's going to achieve the exact opposite. Hu yoter marbe avono, he's going to actually have more sins. Hine Rav Yehuda haya oser lalechet le'eretz Yisrael. Misha holech v'yesh lo isha. All right, this is the Gemara. The Rav Yehuda in the Gemara is oser to go to the land of Israel. Misha holech v'yesh lo isha beveto. Why are we not allowed to go? Because if a person goes to the land of Israel, what's the person asking here? The person's not saying, should I make aliyah and buy a place on and buy a place in Rechavia and have my 401k and be able to live nicely. He's asking if I could just get up and. If I could just get up and move and go myself, just for the sole purpose of my averos being wiped away. And he says, no, because what's going to happen? If a person is married, he's batel mipiri verivya. The guy who goes to Israel is no longer going to fulfill the mitzvah of procreation. Uminat Torah, and he's not going to be able to learn Torah. Uminat tefillah, he's not going to be able to daven. The gorim shetizna ishto. What's going to happen? His wife is going to turn to harlotry. Oh, to her hair. All right? Or she's going to desire to do that. V'im ein lo isha. All right, so you think, oh, maybe Rabbi Yehuda Chassid would say single men are allowed to go. No. Hare kamo kain mitbatel mipiri v'rivya. Right? He's still going to not get a chance to do mipiri v'rivya. He should be staying here trying to get married so he can fulfill the mitzvah of procreation. Uminat Torah, uminat tefillah. So he forgives this qualifier that, you're either going to leave your wife or not leave your wife. If you leave your wife, it's going to be a really bad thing. But if you don't leave your wife, it's almost as bad. It's a really interesting way to answer the question. U'pa'amim, what's also going to happen? U'pa'amim yichalel Shabbat. Oh, yigazlu lo v'yelech levakesh. Oh, yitzarech liftuto min hashevi. What's going to happen? This guy's going to go and he's going to become a machal Shabbos. He's going to come and he's going to violate the Shabbos. Or he's going to turn to theft. Or what's going to happen? He's going to get captured and we're going to end up having to raise money for his release. L'chein mutov sh'yeshe b'vayit v'yipater. It's better that you sit in your house and then you get your kapara that way.
how much did Rabbi Yehuda Chassid actually know?
Excellent question. I would venture that Rabbi Yehuda Chassid did not know much. All right, but he's not entirely wrong. While there was a vibrant Jewish community until really the 10th century, at that point, right, with the under Islamic rule, and then leading into the period of the Crusades, and then after the Crusades, after the Mongol invasion, retaking of the Islamic rule, and then the Mongol invasion in the 13th century, this was not a very pretty place to be for the Jewish community. The assumption, but you're right, he is making assumptions. The assumption that he's making is that you can't earn a living. All right? The assumption that he's making is that there's no Jewish community, no vibrant Jewish community, no world of yeshivot, there's no shul that I can go to, all right? But it is perforce. I will not perform mitzvot. So his argument is very much dependent, it's very much predicated on mitzvot, on a reality that maybe he did, maybe he didn't know about, but he definitely was assuming that this was the case. So, one opinion, yeah.
Isn't he also a concern that his community is going to get smaller? He hasn't had a big enough community to start with.
Maybe, but I don't think that Rabbi Yehuda Chassid is worried about this being a widespread trend. This guy seems like a little bit of an iconoclast asking this question. But, I don't know. I there's no evidence of that. But you could be right. Okay, so that's opinion number one. We're gonna. There's a few different types of ideas here. So let's keep Rabbi Yehuda Chassid in your mind.
Isn't that... The answer reflects the times that this answer was given.
So what I said before is what it definitely reflects is, I don't know what it tells us about Germany, we can talk about it afterwards, but what it tells us about Regensburg, what it does tell us about what the opinion of the land of Israel was, of the people in Regensburg, I would say, the cultural perception of what the land of Israel was during this period in Regensburg. Lefachot. Was Rabbi Yehuda Chassid in correspondence with people in Israel? I don't know, but we know what he thought of the land. And I'm saying that he was not that far off.
Today, no rabbi will ever give this kind of an answer.
Well, I certainly wouldn't give this kind of an answer. Yeah. I'm guessing Rabbi Hochberg wouldn't give that kind of an answer either. But Rabbi Yehuda Chassid knew what he was talking about, and it was also, like I keep saying, it was a different cultural period.
Is it a piece of his answer also about the safety issue?
Yeah.
Which he relates to some of the other places in court also talk about a safety issue, which, again, we don't know if it's valid or not valid, but certainly you had that concern.
Yeah. So I would guess, all right, again, think about the period that we're at. There were definitely people that went. And the fact that Rabbi Yehuda Chassid is answering this means that people have gone. All right? If nobody's ever gone and this guy was just completely out of the blue asking, first of all, why is he asking? Like, you know, it would be like me asking Shiloh, should I go get up and move to Swahili? As if that's something that somebody should do. I would virtually guarantee you that this is not the first person in Regensburg that picked up and left. Now, I'm guessing that the people that picked up and left and went to the land of Israel, they never heard from again, which is not surprising because it was an entire world away and you couldn't really communicate with people back then. And Rabbi Yehuda Chassid wasn't entirely wrong about the state of things in the land. But you're right, yeah.
Well, I'm just a little confused. Isn't this time... It seems to me that in Regensburg they should have known something about the Crusades. The Crusades were beginning.
It depends when this tshuva was written. But yes, in 1096 were the Crusades. They knew about the Crusades. So that's probably, you're probably right. I should have mentioned that. That's probably the main driving point of what they're saying here. The Crusades happened in 1096 when Christians
extremely dangerous.
Passed through Ashkenaz and slaughtered Jewish communities. And now the people that passed through Ashkenaz and were slaughtering Jewish communities are now have jurisdiction over the land of Israel. So he's probably scared stiff from these people, rightfully so. They did not
travel during that time. Yeah. It's very difficult because the Crusades were going on.
Yeah. Okay. I wanna get through more of these. So let's push forward. Okay. Source number two: the Sefer HaTshuva. Now, the first bunch of sources here a lot of them are from the Baalei HaTosafot. Those were the scholars that were operating in France and Germany during those years. Another opportunity. I have a Jewish history, an actual Jewish history unit in mind. And when we do it, Bezrat Hashem will do it properly. We'll go through the history of the Baalei HaTosafot. For now, we're just going to say that these are the Baalei HaTosafot, operating in the early medieval period in France and Germany. Sefer HaTrumah, which was written by Rav Baruch ben Yitzchak Mivermaisa, Rav Baruch ben Yitzchak of Worms, if you want to look on the map to see where Worms is. Okay? He was a contemporary, basically, of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid. Emes. We're in source number two. Ki chaviva eretz Yisrael. He has a little bit more of a upbeat opinion here. At least he starts off that way. Ki chaviva eretz Yisrael. The ashrav ish hadarba. Whoever lives there is to be praised. Somebody, it's good to live there. Ki afilu liotzin mitocha Yechanya the Galuto, even when Yechanya, the king who was exiled in 596 BCE, even when he left, they brought with them the stones and the dirt and the earth of Eretz Israel. This is a poetic way of referring to the established Batei Knesiot in Chutz La'aretz. But the point was that they took, literally, they took the dirt of Eretz Israel to sow the seeds of the Jewish community. In Bavel, the point is that the root of everything that we do is from Eretz Israel anyway, so why would you not want to go back there? That's basically what he's saying. Ubesof, after the dots, Ubesof Ktubot, the Gemara in Ktubot says, Amrinan Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Abba Menashe Kipe de Akko. Rabbi Abba, actually, when he got to Akko, he would lie down and kiss the stones on the floor. Rabbi Chia Bar Abba, Migander Biafra. He would sit around in the dirt. Shneamar, Kiratu Avadecha, Tavanea, Biafra, Yichanenu. The Pasuk in Tehillim, that Sefer HaTruma is saying this. Now, let me finish it, and I'll give you, I should have said this before I read the source. The Chol Shekin, all right? All the more so, Shahadar ba mikayim mitzvot hatluyin ba. Not only is a person having the opportunity to basically rekindle the flame of yesteryear, a person is actually able to fulfill many, many mitzvot. Right? We put the pie chart on last time. What percentage were the mitzvot of the mitzvot hatluyot ba'aretz? Of Shemitah and Yovel and Hafrashot Ma'asrot. That was a huge percentage of the Torah that for a halachically conscious people who are a world away from their promised land, and is completely incapable of fulfilling these mitzvot, it's painful. So, not only that, but you have, but this is kind of like an afterthought that Sefer HaTruma is saying, you have this opportunity to do these mitzvot. Zocha liyot mechitzato shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You have the opportunity to be in the mechitza, right, within the four walls of God. Okay, now who was, I should have said this before, who was the Sefer HaTruma? Baruch ben Yitzchak Mivarmaza, other than the fact that he was from Worms. There was a huge migration that happened in the early 13th century of French Tosafists, French rabbis, leading French rabbis. These are the leading rabbanim in the world who picked up and went to Eretz Israel. And among that group was Baruch ben Yitzchak Mivarmaza. We'll read about their emigration in the next page, but you can mark that off, that the Sefer HaTruma was one of the people that actually went around the year 1211. Okay. Source number three. This is an excerpt from a Tosfot in the margin of a Masechet Ketubot, and this is a well known for people who are working on this sugya, on this topic, a well known opinion. And embrace yourselves. This is a little extreme. V'haya Omer Rabbeinu Chaim. All right. This is known as Rav Chaim HaKohen, who is quoted several times in the Tosfot throughout Shas. Omer Rabbeinu Chaim. The Afshav. Today, these days, and we don't know his birth date and death date, but we know that he was working around 1181, so I put the flourish 1181 here. So get a sense from when we're talking here, late 12th century. The Achshav Eino Mitzvah Ladur Be'eretz Yisrael. Today, there is no mitzvah at all to live in the land of Israel. Why? What's the explanation that he gives? Ki yesh kama mitzvot atluyot ba'aretz, v'kama onshin de'ein anu yecholen lizaher behem la'amod aleihem. So while the Sefer, he says there are all of these mitzvot atluyot ba'aretz, all of these agricultural mitzvot that a person is incapable of fulfilling. Now, note the contrast. All right, these were people; they were bnei dor of one another. They knew one another. They didn't know one another. They knew of one another. They were from the same region, and these are two people that had completely opposing perspectives on making aliyah. One said, you have the opportunity to do some of these mitzvot atluyot ba'aretz that we've been dreaming, we've been fantasizing about doing. And the other one says, there's so many that you're incapable of doing, so there's no mitzvot. So as long as we're incapable of doing these mitzvot, there's no mitzvah at all to go. Now, there's a lot that is discussed about this excerpt in Rav Chaim Cohen, but for now, I just want to leave it in terms of its the implication as far as what it's coming to say. Okay, Divrei HaRambam. So the Rambam in Hilchot Melachim has a very different attitude towards Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. If you have to really read the Hakdama, the introduction of the Rambam to his Yad HaChazakah, to the Mishnah Torah, to his magnum opus, to really appreciate where he's coming from here. But the Rambam had a very, very important... the Rambam held the Jewish history as being essential to halachic history. The Rambam sees the development of halacha to be intricately and intimately linked, unavoidably linked with Jewish self-rule. As long as there's Jewish self-rule and there's a center of Jewish self-rule, halacha can flourish. As long as that is not the case, then halacha is in shambles. Now that's the real main justification he gives for writing his Mishneh Torah, where he basically took the entire world of Torah Shebaal Peh and he reworked it, and he made it in a more of a concise fashion. He said that the Jewish people are going to die without halacha, and since we no longer have a central body of political power, the way that we did in Eretz Israel and the way that we did in Bavel, since that is no longer the case, I need to write this work. Now, again, I'm not doing that justice, but you have to take a look at the Rambam's introduction to the Mishneh Torah. With that introduction, though, take a look at source number 4. This is in Hilchot Malachim. This is the last set of halachot where the Rambam is describing what Yemot HaMashiach are going to be like. HaMelech HaMashiach, the Messiah, Atid La'amod U'lahachzir Malchut David Le'yoshna, L'memshalah HaRishonah. The Melech HaMashiach, the Messiah, is going to come and he's going to return the Davidic monarchy. Ubone HaMikdash U'mekabesh B'chei Yisrael. What's he going to do? He's going to build the Beit HaMikdash. He's going to gather in the exiles of Chutz La'aretz. The Cholzrin Kol HaMishpatim B'yamav Kishahayu Mikodem. One of the first things that the Rambam says about the Yemot HaMashiach is that we are now going to have our system of law the same way that we had originally. Not agricultural mitzvot, not... he doesn't even describe anything about the monarchy. The only thing he tells us that we're going to have a Beit HaMikdash and we're going to have a judicial system. Okay? Which the Rambam sees as essential for the Jewish self-rule. Right? Makriven Karbanot, we're going to have Karbanot. The Osten Shmita and Yovlot, he gets into the Mitzvot HaTluyah Baretz. We're going to do Shmita, we're going to do Yovel. The Chol Mitzvot HaMura B'Torah. Im Asa V'Yitzliach V'Netzach Kol HaUmot Shel Sivav. If we do this properly, and Mashiach is going to be able to get rid of all of the surrounding peoples, Ubona Mikdash from Makomo, and he builds the Mikdash in the proper place, the Kibet Nitchei Yisrael, and he does, and he gathers in the people, Harizem Mashiach Bevadai. Then if this person that does all of these things successfully does them, then we will have no doubt that this person is Mashiach. Now, I'll leave it at that. What I want you to take away from this is that the Rambam has a very different idea of what going to Eretz Israel is supposed to be, what the ultimate redemption is supposed to be. Now, would the Rambam not advocate making Aliyah? I think that he would. It's a separate question. But what I think is very telling in this passage is what the end game for the Rambam always is. It's all about halachic history. It's all about reestablishing the Davidic monarchy. It's all about working towards that point. It's not about being mochel on your avonot. Eretz Yisrael doesn't, for the Rambam, doesn't have that inherent sanctity that Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, that the Sefer HaTruma was talking about. For the Rambam, Eretz Yisrael is a means to political sovereignty, it's a means to halachic independence and the ability to perform its vote. But it's not really about being, the Rambam doesn't say here everybody should go do mochel, and Yemot HaMashiach, everybody's going to go to Eretz Yisrael and we're all going to have our sins wiped free. He's talking about a political reality. Okay, take that. We can talk about it more later. Number 5. This is the Rash Mishantz. The Rash Mishantz is one of the most important of the Balei HaTosafot. He was a student of Rabbeinu Tam, and he was one of the people on the list in the year 1211 who made Aliyah. Le'inyan nidrach neder, as a typo, neder shenidarta la'alot Eretz Yisrael. This is a responsa. He's responding to somebody. With regards to the vow that you took, a person took a vow, I take upon this myself as vow to go to the land of Israel. Yesh lecha hafara acharei she'ishtecha hara. After your wife becomes pregnant, you can have that vow canceled and you don't have to go to the land of Israel. Why? De'ein kol iser omed b'fnei pikuach nefesh. There's no iser, this iser that he created upon himself of not fulfilling his vow. There's nothing that's going to stand in the way of saving a life. Ve'yesh sakana l'holicha ubra. And it's dangerous for a pregnant woman to travel. This was a tough travel. The Rash Sens was in France. You could look at the map. So this is a world away here. Vegam hayeled ad sheyizkaber v'yikantzu yimot hakayitz. Right, and so it's still dangerous until the baby grows up, and then summer months comes because you can't travel in the winter months. Va'al tishiveni, don't say back to me. She'ein zeh pikuach nefesh lefi shetucha lelech lo ishtecha. Don't say. He's anticipating a question of the show up, the person asking the question. Don't say, no, I can go without my wife and everything will be fine. Don't say that. That's a bad attitude. Zehebel. That's incorrect. Putting it lightly. Hilo tucha la'agna. What would that result in? If you go without her, you're essentially going to chain her to you and you're going to be in a foreign land. Right? That's going to make her an aguna. Ve'atam shubadla. Right? In some very egalitarian, important Right? This is the type of stuff that I read in Rishonim, and actually kind of it puts me in a good mood. Yiru Meshubadla. You, the husband, are now subservient to your wife. Umitzvah merubah, it is a great mitzvah, it's an important language. V'yesh lo hafara. Therefore, the vow that you took to be ole la'aretz can be cancelled. Alright? So, for the Rash Mishans, who, again, important to note, he made aliyah, for the Rash Mishans, what's the reason to not go? Right? It's dangerous, it's practical, your wife's pregnant. Alright? But that's really the only thing in the way. You'd have to assume, based on what he says, that if the guy's wife wasn't pregnant, or if the guy wasn't married, the Rash Mishans was very into the idea. The only, considering all the things, or forget the Rambam, but the first three, the objections that were raised, considering those, this is a pretty powerful type of language that the Rash Mishans is giving us. Okay, Rav Meir in Rotenberg, another one of the Bali Atosos. The last of the Bali Atosos, really. Again, we're talking about in a response to literature. Rav Shasha'alta, Im Shamata, Lama Tzavu Agdolim Livneihim Lapsor, Meretz Yisrael. You asked me, why do all these people whose children went to Israel, why are their parents telling them to come back? Now, what's going on here? What year? He's a generation later, the Rav Meir in Rotenberg. So, these are all the Tosafists and the people in their generation that went in the year 1211. Now, there's a community there. They have, think about it, it's parents who live here, and their kids make aliyah, and now the parents are lonely without them, they're worried about them, so they're sending them letters, get yourself back here. I don't like it that you're there. That's what was being asked. So this Shoel, the person asking the question, got wind of the fact that the parents whose children went to Israel around the year 1211 were being asked to return. And he's asking the Maharam Rutenberg why that was the case. And he answers in the bold, in source number 6. B'medume ani, this is my conjecture, he's saying, he doesn't know this for a fact, b'vishayin sham rachamim klal, because there's no mercy there. I don't know what life was like in Ashkenaz, but apparently nobody had to work. Because everybody, right. One of the chief complaints is that when they get to Eretz Yisrael, all of a sudden you need to get a job in order to live. Mm-hmm. So he's saying that the reason why everybody was worried and why everybody wants their kids back is because in Israel everybody needed to get a job. B'gam mitoch she'ein sham Torah, einam b'kiyei b'tikdudei mitzvotah. That's what I think I heard from their children. There's no Torah there, and people aren't Shomer Torah mitzvahs over there. So as a result, we can't have anything to do with them anymore. Okay? So again, less, more of a power of type of a thing, meaning he's not endorsing it, but he does say that the land is not conducive. So unless you have a strong center. What we lost in Eretz Yisrael is what we need in order to encourage people to go back. The Meiri. Number 7. Meiri was from Provence, southern France. He lived in Narbonne. Kol makom, this is source number 7. Kol makom shechachma v'irat chet mitzuyin sham, dino ke'eretz Yisrael. Alright, this is a pretty intense statement by the Meiri. Any place that has a center of Torah, that has people who are God-fearing, who fear sin, and there's wisdom there, that place is like Eretz Yisrael. Kmosha Amar kol adar b'Bavel ki udar b'Eretz Yisrael. Chazal treat Bavel very important, very significantly, because they were writing in Bavel, and Bavel was the center of the Jewish world. So the Meiri is arguing that the reason why Bavel, Babylonia, was able to attain this status is because it was such a great, wonderful place with yeshivas and everything. So this is a pretty extreme formulation in the other direction, but I think it's building off of a lot of what we've seen already. If there's nothing to do there, you have no Jewish life there, there's no infrastructure, since there's no infrastructure, you can't go. Divrei Rabbi Shimon ben, alright, this is from the Tashbetz. I'll tell you what, we'll leave this one now. And I want to do the source number 9, because it's we're skipping a couple of centuries. Alright, the Tashbetz is a century later, and then this, Rav Shlomo Levi Alkabetz. What did Rav Shlomo Levi Alkabetz write that was very famous? The Chadodi. Right, it's the first letter or word of each phrase of the Chadodi spells Shlomo Alevi. Shlomo Alevi Alkabetz made aliyah with what famous Jew? Lived in Spain. Is very important in terms of the history of halacha. Yosef Karo, the Shulchan Aruch. Right? They made Aliyah at Tzfat. They were the center of the Kabbalists that lived in Tzfat in the 15th and 16th century. Shlomo Levi Alkevitz, this is a letter that he was writing to Rav Yosef Karo, Baderech, while making Aliyah. Rab Mchashu, ki malat Eretz Yisrael halohi behiyot am bnei Yisrael betochav. There are lots of people who think that what is so great about the land of Israel, it's the Jewish people when they live there. Right? That's certainly what many of the Balei HaTosfot that we were just reading would say. And it loses its sanctity, it loses its status when they're gone. They think that the only reason that Eretz Israel is a significant place is because we can do mitzvot there. They're making a mistake when they have this opinion. Right? We're in the bold now, in source number 9. Avalda, ki shleimut Eretz Yisrael hu ba'atzmuta mamash. What is the perfection of the land of Israel is in its essence. It's in its very nature. Ki hi haita nukuda harishona bebriya. It was the original intention of creation. For anybody who's here for the original, the first of the shiurim that I gave, this actually strikes a very resonant chord with me. That Eretz Yisrael was the very, very idea at the moment of creation. We'll skip to the next bold. Zuhora araba, ki shleimuta ba'atmuta kamo sheyesh eretz migadelet peirot yoter mizulata. How great is it? It's a land that grows peirot yoter mizulata. It grows more fruit than it theoretically should. Yesh motzim hakesef v'zahav v'avanim tovot margoliot makom zulat makom. Think he's talking about how there's gems, money flowing from the streets, right? This was not what the what Eretz Yisrael looked like in the 16th century. I promise you. But they had a very... It's not... Once we start having the discourse of the Kabbalists about Eretz Yisrael, we start to have a little very different type of theme talking about Eretz Yisrael. For the Balei HaTosafot, for the Ashkenaz, and for French Jews, a big part of it was Shmirat Halacha, or Shmirat HaMitzvot. When we get into the Kabbalists, certainly when we're getting into the 15th, 16th century Kabbalists, it's about the etzem, the nature of the land. Okay, so the next three sources, right, which we're pretty much done here, the next three sources are actually describing a few of the primary sources that I collected about the actual migration of Rabbanim during the Middle Ages. I'm going to skip those. Everybody can do them self-study. I just want to tell you a couple of very quick stories about people that made Aliyah. Okay? Who do we know? All right, I mentioned the Rashi Shantz. I mentioned a couple of important people. Who else do we know? Important Rabbanim from the Middle Ages that made Aliyah.
Ramban
name. Anybody else?
Yehuda Levi.
Anybody else that we know of? Trying to think. Is there anybody else important? So, okay, that's probably and I would say Rabbi Yosef Karo is probably the other one. The Shla did, yeah. He's actually my Alter Zeda.
Really?
Yeah. All right, so there were some very important people. This was not a trend that started in 1211 and ended in 1211. This was a trend that went on for centuries. Important Rabbanim that ended up making Aliyah. Interesting, it's important to note that in every single one of these cases of important Rabbanim that made Aliyah, usually there was some unpleasant event that precipitated it. The Ramban in 1263 did something very difficult in Barcelona. Anybody know what? In a disputation of Barcelona in 1263.
In front of the king.
In front of the... He actually had to get up and argue with this guy, Nicholas Donin, who was a former... who was a convert from Judaism to Christianity. And he had to defend Judaism in front of the... Now, which account you go by depends on who you're going to say who won the debate. But what we do know is that within 2 years of that, after being one of the most famous Jews in the world, one of the most important rabbis in the world, within a year and a half of that event, he skips town. And he wanders around for several years until eventually he makes it to Eretz Yisrael. He starts in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim was desolate, devoid of Jews for centuries until the Ramban gets there. And he starts what? That we all know in the Rova of the Old City. He starts a shul that is still standing today. It's a little bit nicer than it did in the days of the Ramban, but it's still there. And he starts a shul, and eventually he heads to Akko, where a lot of the Rabbanim do. He starts a yeshiva there that becomes quite famous. That's the Ramban. But Yechiel Miparis, who is another very important rabbi, he's one of the Balei HaTosfot, he lives a little bit before the Ramban, also, he was party to a very unpleasant disputation with a guy named, what's the guy's name again? Anybody remember anything about the disputation of Paris? I wrote it down here, one second. The Chacham Lebedev, right. The Visitation of Paris is in 1240. Oh, that was with Nicholas Donin. Pablo Christiani is the 1263. So it's 1240 is Nicholas Donin. Again, he makes Aliyah within a few years also. It's in 1240. He makes Aliyah to Akko in the 1250s. So, same thing. So some unpleasant event. He doesn't. Disputations were the worst because there was no winning them. You basically you argued, and it wasn't exactly an impartial jury that was judging your arguments. So you can be sure that the Ramban knew religion better than Pablo Christiani. But despite that, he was still considered to have lost the debate by the Christians in the crowd. So that also precipitated it. The Rambam tries to get to Israel, but he doesn't stay because he can't for a lot of the same reasons. When he's 13 years old, he grew up in Cordoba, Spain. And when he's 13 years old, the Almohads invade Cordoba, and they force him to Morocco. He's in Morocco for about 10 more years, and then he has to get on a boat and he goes to Akko. And he tries to stay in Israel. If everybody take a look, it's really just golden. Source number 12, you'll read it later, is a letter that the Rambam writes to his host in Akko 20 years later. And he's talking about, oh, you remember that time that we were in Akko together and you showed us around? I was there with my father and brother. And the Rambam basically spends, we don't know how long, but he spends a significant amount of time in Eretz Israel and then eventually makes his way down to Egypt and goes there. So, just a recap. So we started off with, I think, an important halakhic history of what led to the period of the Rishonim. We then went into these different approaches, these different ideas, these different ideologies about the land of Israel that existed in the time of the Rishonim. And we ended off, and everybody, the map I think is really important, just to reference what regions we're talking about here. And then we ended off with this idea, with a number of examples of people that actually did make Aliyah throughout the Middle Ages. What I think is important to note is whether it's halachic, whether it's even messianic, whether it's about inherent sanctity of the land, the desire, the passion, and commitment to the land of Israel by Am Yisrael and by its vibrant leadership throughout the entire Middle Ages did not wane, even for a moment. And even for those who were against making Aliyah, it was not because the land was not worthy of our time. It's that the land was too sanctified and too special. So when we think about Eretz Yisrael, and again, I think it's so important, anytime that we talk about Zionism, we start with Herzl, we're ignoring thousands of years of Jewish... I mean, I really think that I think the discussion needs to start at Briyat HaOlam, because that's when Zionism for me really starts. So it's important to realize that 800-900 years before Herzl was talking in Western Europe about repopulating the land of Israel with the Jewish people, there were many, many very important Jews that predated him and had very much a similar idea on their mind. Shkoch.
Yeah.